I hate you, Steve.
I always love starting the episode laughing. Trying to be self-serious. He was just so caught off guard. He was like, trying to hold that laughing.
Yo.
Yo, well.
Yo. Hi, folks. Welcome back.
What a pivot.
To another episode of I'm Not Supposed to Be Here.
I'm not supposed to be here.
Nah, if you're listening to that clip, that shit is so
yes,
funny.
Indeed.
I am one of your hosts, Trent L. Dixon.
Shout out, Wilhan.
Shout out, Wilhan. And I'm sitting a clock. Oh my God. A Santa Claus, right? My main man.
Hey, Eclectic Sage, you know, on time today, all on the clock. On the clock, clocked in, punched in, punching in, because Mike, you already know we keep it, we ad-libbing. And I'm also sitting next to the wonderful
Stephen Basile. I need to come up with a better name or something. I don't know. I say it and it's like, damn.
No, that's a fire name. I don't know what you mean.
It has aura to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have no aura whatsoever. No. But I'm also sitting across from
Mari, also known as Slow Rewind. Ooh. Fine artists, you guys know me from last week. I appreciate everyone here, and I appreciate being on the show.
Yeah.
See, that's a cool ass name, man.
Yeah. Like,
we gotta step ours up, Trent.
What? this is the Black Bro.
That's why I put the L in there. You know,
it makes it feel a little extra, a little special.
Okay, so I'm the plain one. Got it. Cool.
Is L Esquire?
Did I ever reveal what the L stands for on the show?
No, I don't think so. I think the audience deserves to know.
Good. I like some mystery. Yeah. I like to keep a little mystery.
Oh, well, I guess we don't deserve to
Wait,
know.
Do you have a middle name?
Yes. Oh. And it actually does begin with L.
Oh.
So now I'm going to have to try to guess it now, but I'm going to do that now.
Wait, do you have a middle name?
Of course I do.
I'm crying.
Starts with A.
Whoa.
Ooh. Ooh. You look like an Alfred.
Yeah, this is
Stephen
so
Alfred Basile.
I'm not that cool.
Yeah, this is funny. Because like when I'm no visual cool. people are like, I see it too.
I see it too. I'll show you mine like if you show me yours.
Okay.
Oh, Lord.
Maybe by the end of the episode. Okay. We'll see how
it's
this
a little
goes.
Too early in the night for that.
Oh, man. It's so fun recording at night. I remember when we recorded like mid-afternoon and day. Like we're so excited.
I need food.
Yeah, we're like so excited and stuff. That was like very chill. Very,
yeah.
Very cutesy, very demure. I'm dating myself, but I love cutesy and demure. It's a fun combo. Bro, like it's dead. I'm like, no. For me, no. Yeah.
It's not dead as long as you would keep it alive.
Yeah, no, yeah. Absolutely. Language is language.
How's everybody doing? How's everybody's week been?
Hey, man, I've been great. I've been taking it one day at a time. You know, it was very weird earlier this week. I felt like listening. I've been listening to you guys' podcast a lot. Like, just trying to learn how to become a better co-host. Whatever, guest. I don't fucking know. I'm here to be myself, and I'm here to be the best version of myself. And I don't know if I was self-conscious or it was a self-esteem thing, but I was definitely listening back to it. And I was like, I gotta do better next time.
Hey, but, I mean, we're always doing better every day. When we first started, we were a little rough.
That was me on the first one. I was so nervous. Ugh.
That's me every episode.
I'm actually like pissing myself right now. You just
can't see it. Hey, this is why we keep the video off for at least for this season.
Yep. At least for this season.
Yeah.
You did really well. I don't know.
I appreciate the gentleman.
Yeah. I know how it is being an artist. You're being hard on yourself. Unnecessarily so, but I do appreciate you wanting to be better.
And the honesty and the vulnerability, and it's fire because like it's fun to do the podcast, and when you get that range of like comfortability, it's just a lot of fun, a lot of ad-libbing, a lot of just playing off of each other. I like that the podcast is not really all that edited because it's just like this is just a really raw kind of format of conversation.
That's the best part. That's the best kind.
That's the best kind of conversation. Yeah. It's the one that just flow. You don't have to like edit it or change it around. It's just good later.
Yeah. I did change around some stuff on the last one though.
Oh, you did? Yeah. Oh, I forgot.
Because we name dropped a place.
Oh yeah, I forgot.
So I did have to go and edit that out.
But the place that shall not be named.
Yes, yeah. That place. I actually said it on air.
That's funny. I remember. I didn't get to so listen to the episode yet.
Yeah.
I didn't hear it. It was just bleeped out, right?
Something like that.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, this is an actual like cut. Oh, this is funny. Yeah. Let me go check that out.
But I wanted it to be weird. Anyway, how's everybody's week been?
I'm excited. Shout out to Good Natured Souls for all people that are aren't aware. Shout out to GNS. You know, Good Natured Souls is going to be like a music label. It's going to be filled with Jules from the X, Janai, Jazz.
What?
Free of Spirit, too, also known as Andrew Matthew now. Just changed the name. Prince Inspiration, myself, and many others in the future. So just very happy to speak to it. And yeah, we just had a lot of shows this week. There's another show tomorrow. Yeah, it's been a busy week. So at least most, if not everybody, had a show within like the last 2 weeks or so. So good kind of like stuff on that. Oh, and also Tiara Vernon. Yeah, she's amazing. I'm so excited. I can't wait for her project to come out. That's all I'm going to say. She's probably my favorite project for like just casual listening, just to something to live with. That one's a lot of fun to listen to.
Yeah, everybody's got really good projects. Yeah. That one's definitely special.
That one's
they're all special. I don't want to make anybody feel like this.
I know.
But they're all good. They're all really, really good.
I think Manifest is a classic. I'm going to call it now before it's even out.
I think I was telling Jules the other day, like the beginning and the end of Manifest is crazy, and I can't wait to play that on the podcast.
It's like a full circle moment type of work.
Yeah.
I know people are like, oh man, I haven't heard any of it. So
it's like, what the hell are they talking about?
But yeah, I mean, it's for us to know and for you to find out.
Eventually, you'll hear it. You'll catch up. How about y'all? What's up?
I mean, mine was pretty plain. You know, work, some reading, on the train.
Hey, what you been reading?
Loving the Wife. About it.
Hey,
I've been reading. I started the Red Rising trilogy recently. It's a sci-fi series by the author Pierce Brown. Really good. Really good. It's a bit dark.
A quick synopsis of that, real quick.
All right, I'll try to do a quick one. I'm so bad at like elevator pitches or whatever. But it's basically about it takes place in our future solar system world, whatever. And it's about a society that has basically been reduced to a caste system that separates people by color.
Ooh, wow.
And you have the low colors, like the reds, the blues, the greens, the yellows, who are overruled by the gold class, who is this peak of like human existence that like feels like, because they were able to take, you know, the rest of the solar system by force, they are the ones who should be able to rule while the others toil underneath them. And it's about a red named Darrow, who has his wife killed in front of him by a gold.
Wow.
And is approached by this uprising of other low colors that are like, we're tired of this. We're going to basically turn you into a gold to infiltrate them and take them down from the inside.
Hunger Games, but it's not Hunger Games.
Yeah, it's really, honestly, really good. It is a bit darker, but not super dark. But it's a great series so far.
That's darker than.
I would say dark. Along the lines of the Hunger Games books, not the movies. The movies weren't as dark as the books, in my opinion.
The books were pretty dark. Like, for young adult fiction, they were pretty pretty descriptive of like the nature of the violence, and it was like it didn't like make it so that the violence was like pretty. It was like very grotesque, and it was like, this is actually happening to kids. Like, make sure that you're like taking this into account. And it was just like, it was good. It made the story a lot better, like to read, honestly, when you're just like going through it. And the suspense is great in that movie too.
I think the best blurb from the book that sets the tone best, and it's like a little excerpt in regards to like hanging, essentially.
Yeah.
And it basically goes, on Mars, you have to pull the legs to crack the neck. Wow. They let the loved ones do it.
Wow. That's
and so yeah, foul. That like I was like, oh my god.
But wow.
Yeah.
But
so
it's just like, it's also like, I feel like the dramatic kind of like punchiness of that, and I could tell it's like a good, like well written book. It's just whenever an artist uses syntax and just plays with like syntax and just the way that a sentence is structured and just like breaks it down to like its core things just to give like just straight punch. It's like a visceral reaction.
You know? Like that really, it's that hook that kind of. In those two sentences, I was like, I'm reading this book. That's all you need.
Just, that's how you could tell. Like, some books now, when I read them, I'm just like, yeah, this is not well written. Like, I can't read it anymore.
Oh, yeah. I've had that happen to me, too.
But there's so many books like that. And that's the only bad thing with certain books, that yes, for simplicity, you can have a simple book, but if you just do bare things of like syntax, it's just, you don't need to use like crazy flowery language. You just gotta communicate. Mm-hmm. Just play with
like the hero's journey.
Yeah,
hero's journey. One of classic tropes. One of the most classic tropes of any story.
Yeah. Yeah, but you're talking about Joseph Campbell, right? Like reading the book? Or just like hero's journey in general?
No, hero's journey in general.
Oh, the hero's journey in general. Yeah. I mean, the hero's journey is like an interesting trope, and it's funny because like I feel like some of the mysticism of that book comes from the fact that people think that every book is a hero's journey. But I mean, or like every story could fit into that. So sometimes they do like kind of like, you know, we'll discount all these kind of facts and details that don't support it and just mm-hmm. kind of fit it into the hero's journey. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's just a trope also. And it's just like, it uses like archetypes. And I remember when I was younger, shout out to this YouTube channel, it's like Overly Sarcastic Productions. They used to do Trope Talk. Mm-hmm. If you're a bookworm, you know about them.
Oh, I know
them. Yeah, they used to do like the animations. And I remember the host had like a book called Trope Talk, and she'll talk about archetypes and trope writing. And yeah, the hero journey is like one of the more popular tropes, from taking a person from status quo to status quo, but changing as a person in the between times. But yeah, there's a lot of, that's like high key for narrative storytelling, mm-hmm. which kind of goes into our topic for the day, if Ooh. I'm going to segue.
Beautiful segue.
Yeah, hey, might as well segue since it's here.
Might as well.
Yeah, our topic for today is?
We're talking about narratives, specifically the narrative of the villain. And we're going to be speaking a little bit to the evolution and the roles that they play in the stories and, you know, how they have a subsequent effect on our hero.
That's fire. And they're a crucial part in the hero's journey for a lot of tropes. Yeah, so definitely. I guess how would you kind of take your opinion or kind of how do you view the hero's journey?
Me, myself, I feel as if I have to pull out my notes.
While you're searching for your notes, I just want to kind of break it down just a little bit and sort of talk about the different eras that the villain has existed in and how it's existed. That, you know, hopefully to help us provide some context. So,
number one question, what is a villain?
So, really a villain is an antagonist, a narrative, or sometimes the villain doesn't necessarily have to be a person. I forget the specific term for it, mm-hmm. But there's a really cool term that I learned that I didn't write down. It's actually on my other laptop because I was working off like two. Because I'm weird like that.
Oh, you were just hacking into the mainframe. But you just had the five screens that had to be.
Easy, Neo. Damn.
What about Neo?
Real quick, though, I saw some shit I might buy that's going to give me like four screens on this.
Damn.
And it's affordable. And I was like, I can do that for work and for editing. And for writing.
Oh, man. That computer guy that's in the Matrix?
Dozer? Tank and
yeah,
Dozer?
Yeah, take it. Yeah. Yeah. You're going to be he's going to give me the locks.
Just going to be bumping us some Depeche Mode. Just yeah. like.
Nah. Mark's like, I haven't seen the
what
Matrix.
What is Depeche Mode?
I mean, it's a. The specific to the one I'm talking about is like the. Da-da-da-da.
No.
I've never heard that. Really? I mean, that's the only thing I know about them. I'll show you after the podcast. Yeah. But it's the perfect like hacker sound.
Thank you. Yo, really? Oh, that's just fun. I'm like,
no, but the villain is there to create obstacles and to separate a hero from their wants and or needs, I would say, in a very simplistic way.
Yeah.
Anybody have a better definition than that?
I mean, that's pretty good. I mean,
yeah,
it does go deeper than that, but it really depends on the situation and the mm-hmm. villain and the story and stuff like that. But absolutely. On like the surface level, it is essentially what you said. It's the person that it kind of goes opposite of your protagonist and you know tries to stop him from doing what he wants to do.
So. Yeah, and I think I feel like heroes and villains tend to be opposites of each other, but they're like mirror reflections of each other.
Mm.
And
at times, yes.
And it's just like a lot of times, especially in recent narrative kind of storytelling, the villains tend to take specific traits from the heroes and just corrupt them.
And I think a lot of times they're not necessarily opposites. A lot of times they're the same. You know, the biggest difference between heroes and villains, I think, is how they react to their situation or their circumstances. But anyway, I was going to go through this specific area.
We're jumping way ahead. Yes.
No. I love tangents. We love tangents here. So it's defined by different eras. So... So the golden age of villains, and we're sticking sort of to, but we're not going exclusive to comic books and movies, just to kind of narrow it down because it is a very broad subject because you can look at different literature, you know, just you can go all over the place with it. You can even look at like historical actual villains, but I digress. So the 1930s and the 1950s sort of was a golden age for villains, and that's sort of more looked at as your mustache twirling, simplistic, let's tie a damsel in distress on the train tracks, you know, let's blow up the city. Very straightforward, normally embodying clear-cut evil. You can look at, you know, the first appearances of, say, the Joker or Lex Luthor or even Doctor Doom. You know, not a lot of times, not very much backstory. And then you have the mid-1950s to 1970s, and that's when you see that's called the Silver Age, and that's when you see a shift in complexity. And they sort of gained more tangible motivations, a lot of mental instability, a lot of tragic backstories. You can look at Magneto, the Riddler, Green Goblin, things like that. And then your 1970s to 1980s sort of birthed the anti-hero and anti-villain. These are people who are more morally ambiguous. They live in sort of a gray area, and they sort of started to, I guess, acknowledge a system that was a little more corrupt.
Yeah.
And they were responding to that. You can look at Venom, Thanos, and even in some cases the Punisher. And then then the 1990s to present, you get your modern / postmodern villains that have a little
one of my favorite type of villains.
Of course. that are a little more personal with their motives. They're very multifaceted, they're very complex. And a lot of times you'll find audiences sympathizing with them. You know, you have your Killmongers, your Dark Knight Jokers, and of course, once again, Thanos, Lokis, and things like that. So, yeah, and keep in mind, folks, when we're talking about these eras, when we do mention them, they are not, what's the word I'm looking
like,
for?
Like, there's no clear-cut division between when one starts and when one ends.
Yeah, right? and there's a lot of overlap. And there doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, there's no overlap. Like, you can get a Bronze Age villain in post-modern era as well. So it's not like across the board. Segmented. But it's a lot of what was, I guess, what was popular and what is done a lot throughout that era. All right, okay, so.
Hey, can we get a bar for that? that was a great breakdown.
Appreciate you. But I feel like I'm giving myself the horn.
Yeah, just.
you did great.
So, back to your notes. Let's hear what the great Mari has to say.
You put me on the spot, man. What's the first question we're starting with? The first one I have here is, what is the value of the villain in these stories?
Yeah, so, I mean, if there's... okay. I mean,
yeah, that's a good starting place, honestly.
What I have is what is the value of these villains in these stories? For me, the answer is to reflect on the seven deadly sins. Off the top of my head, I put here, Dr. Doom is prideful. He is the man. He's number one. He literally gets the gauntlet in one of the stories. I'm not sure which one, but he is Dr. Doom. He's the guy. He's supposed to be number one. He is prideful. He's representative of that sin. Thanos is lustful for Mistress Death. Obviously, he tries to get rid of half the population, but he does it for her hand in love. He wants to be seen and acknowledged by her.
Yeah.
So for me personally, I would say lustful. But I feel like the best villains are a mixture of 2 to 4 sins. Like Ultron. So Ultron is wrathful and envious. So
yeah.
He is wrathful, because he hates all humans, but he is also envious because he cannot be human. Mm, almost like Am from, what's that book? Am.
I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking
about. I know who you're talking about. That's a very, very deep cut.
Am. Yeah, you guys know at home. Good
How book. Do you spell that?
A-M.
A-M. I remember because I had a, it was like, I had a Hulk encyclopedia when I was younger. And a Spider-Man encyclopedia, and he's like mentioned, he crosses paths with them.
Oh, Ultron?
No, Am.
Am is a beautiful villain. He is oh, I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream.
My wife loves that book.
It is a beautiful book. But back to what I was saying, it's the best villains are 2 to 4 sins, and the best hero are 2 to 4 sins. The opposite.
Yeah.
The opposite of greed is to give away.
Mm-hmm. Like the virtues of
everything. Yes, you get what I'm trying to say? For me, that's how I would write up a superhero, for me, personally.
Yeah, that's. I think that's a...
damn it, Mario. I was self-conscious, and you come out swinging.
Yeah, he was ready.
I love that.
That was beautiful.
That was. No, I think that's a very interesting take, especially... It tends to it kind of lends itself to how I feel about villains. I don't know why I'm cleaning. It's not my table. It's like the best villains tend to be not necessarily an opposite, but a reaction to our hero. You know, there's a good amount of balance between them, and I think that your take kind of displays that. What did you say, Dr. Doom was?
Doom is prideful. Pride, he is pride. The sin of pride.
Yeah. I like that, like, villains over time, they kind of reflect the transitions of, let's say, like a core kind of prideful type of moment, and then take that across different eras, because that's like a very human thing. But the ways in which it manifests in society, it can be reflected in the golden age hero, just the mustache twirling hero, or just like the postmodern hero that has a complicated backstory and has motivations that are fully realized, but still kind of falls into like that kind of prideful, ego-based type of thing. And it changes from time to time to kind of speak to it. And I kind of want to go on a side tangent to bring, I guess, like a meta narrative type of angle to it. So meta, anytime you think about meta, is just talking about the environment that creates the type of stories that you inhabit. So like you're saying, like it has a kind of 7 deadly sins. So when you look at it, it's just like, oh yeah, where is American comics are often seen as like the American mythology. And so if you take the history of America and everything, and the ways in which, you know, Protestantism is like pervasive in just the structure of our society, it makes a lot of sense why, you know, a hero or a villain may be put in the framework of 7 deadly sins.
Yes.
And it would be, that's the kind of meta narrative, and why specific eras speak to specific things.
Yes.
And then another thing I wanted to also mention and include, shout out to... I think his name is Scott Nysander from NerdSync, but he talks about the Comics Authority, who was also in charge of, you know, providing censorship during specific eras. Mm-hmm. And that also kind of curbed the nature of the narratives to the way in which Silver Age became like a little bit less hero-centered and more monster-centered, and then how that worked itself back into monster-making movies and media that kind of followed subsequently. But yeah, I think you hit the nail right on the head with just like emulating a kind of wrath or type of sin in that type of Western mentality, and how it pervades in the mythology that we create through superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
And just how, you know, that's a super important way to write a, like a hero. And it's a good like super fire framework to kind of start. But I guess, how do you feel?
I really like the allegory of villains being represented by sins, and especially, you know, the heroes being the opposite. For me, my favorite type of villains are, you know, most people are pretty happy with like the classic villains who, like, you know, just come in and mess things up because they can or because they want to. And, you know, you have that hero who's like, I know what's right from wrong. I'm going to come swoop in and save the day.
Yeah, the agents of chaos versus the agents of
order. Yeah, exactly. You know, you got, oh, this thing is wrecking the city. I have to stop it. You know, and that's a bare bones thing. But like, for me, as the narrative of heroes and villains evolved over the years, especially in regards to like comic books or movies and stuff like that, I really found myself drawn to the villains that I almost empathized with.
Yeah.
Like,
absolutely.
the ones that really make you think, like you mentioned Killmonger. Ooh. Killmonger is one of my most favorite villains of all time. Well, like, the Black Panther movie was amazing by itself, but it truly transcended, I feel, because of Killmonger. Because it was one of the first times I can really recall looking at that and thinking, wow, I'm really not sure if he's a villain. Because, like, what he's saying is so unbelievably true. The only thing really separating from him and making him into a villain was how he was maybe going about it. But otherwise, like, it's one of those gray areas where the line is so thin, for a second you don't know which side you're ending up on. And for me, those are the most amazing villains, the ones that make you think, and the ones that really, really resonate with you on, like, some type of primal level.
I was about to say, like, Killmonger definitely inspired this episode, because I think we had a conversation and it was talking about how radical messages often get put onto villain archetypes and characters. And, you know, in the kind of realm of politicals and in the political spectrum, with kind of like a liberal type of leaning hero, with just kind of, you know, piecemeal type of diplomacy and kind of creating that neoliberalism idea of just having, you know, we'll work it out within time with diplomacy. And then you have like a kind of radical figure that kind of went and lost his way. And that speaks to a lot of like what we experienced in like postmodernism with like people like MLK versus, and they put it MLK versus the story of Malcolm X. And they say like, look, there was the right and the wrong way. And so there's a lot of very, I guess, timely references that they make in the creation of these stories to make you really think, like, these people were very aligned at the end of both of their lives, but, you know, it's the way that it facilitates, it's the way that it structures. And, you know, rest in peace to Chadwick Boseman, because I know that they wanted to bring the story a different direction, but I love the direction that they did for Black Panther 2.
Agreed.
But I could tell, like, the writers really wanted to keep on pushing that forward with Ryan Coogler and everything, too.
You know, a lot of comic book fans really dislike the MCU, and I really hate that, because even though they say it's not realistic, it's not... it's too realistic. It's not close to the comics at all. It's not as cartoony. They don't dress the way they should.
It's not supposed to be.
It's not supposed to be. You know what I mean? Yeah. And when we get moments like Tony in Endgame when he snaps, and you know Robert Downey Jr. Oh, man.
It's
7 years.
It's crazy that that's 7 years. I remember that
trailer nerding out for a little bit when that trailer dropped.
That was such a... And they didn't even use that scene.
I must have watched that shit like 60 times. I was ready.
I'll take that and I'll raise... Not to cut you off. But I'll raise you, like, being in the theater, midnight, Endgame.
Wow.
One of the most insane experiences of my life.
It was insane. It was crazy.
Yo, when Mjolnir came to Cap, I still get goosebumps.
My theater erupted.
What?
It was one of the only times, and I still now... I did not care how loud that place was, because I was loud too. I was screaming. It was insane. I only felt
that like one time before, and that was at the beginning of the Star Wars series when they finally brought it back, when like Rey came onto the screen, and then it was like, it was just the title card and people were excited. But
people were ready. Fuck the haters. I love the MCU, especially the first 3 to 4 phases. It's not to say that they haven't had low points, but yo, as far as
consistency and quality is
great. And their contributions to comic book culture as a whole, yo, like, you can't deny that,
you know.
And it's exactly what Mario was saying, where it's like, it wasn't, people were mad because they thought, oh, this is so like different from the comics and how it was supposed, but that's not how it was supposed to be. It's a different medium.
That's
for
true.
A different time period. And it those movies were meant to not only, you know, meant to sell movies and be epic and be awesome, but also meant to convey the issues and problems that were going on for us right now.
Absolutely.
You know, it was any movie of the is an allegory of that time, and just because it fits into the realm of like superheroes doesn't make that any different.
Facts.
All right. So
spitting.
Wait, did you have some more?
No,
I was going to say, one of the greatest, most well-aged supervillains of all time is always going to be Magneto.
I can't wait
till he joins back into the MCU. He was in there, but like, you know, that Sony universe kind of disconnected. Unfortunately, right now, they're trying to build up for it, and I've definitely seen it. And that's one of the problems with the Marvel films. I see what they're trying to build as, like, a film critic, as a guy who knows film. It's like, I can't say that they're going the wrong way about it, but it's like, oh, you guys had something, but you're so firm in what you believe and what's already set up.
Yeah.
That you can't fall back.
Yeah, that's another thing, like, with just the medium of comics, and I was talking about this with, like, Spider-Man, it's just like, and the nature of, like, maybe they should let mainline Spider-Man grow up. And I've been having this argument with people.
It is time.
Like, the fact that he, like, the writers themselves came out and said that we're not going to let him grow up is, like, that's a tragedy in itself, because you're just limiting the nature of, like, where you can take a character. Absolutely. There's a lot of interesting things that you can do with already established people. And it's just, like, it's okay for time to pass for a character, well, or for time to
kind of work. Now that you actually said that, there is an actual current run on Ultimate Comics. They restarted it up. Yeah. And he is grown up in that story. Yeah, it's
It is. He's like 30 something with kids.
Oh, yeah. That's really cool.
It's actually really good too. I wish to see an older Spider-Man. I wish they would have titled it something else, because they've already done an Ultimate run of comics. Yeah. But anyway, that's besides the point.
Tangent.
But yeah, but so it's funny that you said what you said.
Yeah.
Because that was gonna be my answer to the value of the different types of villain.
Yes.
I would say that a villain in itself, it represents a lot of the problems and issues with society. And then so that villain a good villain forces your hero to deal with some of those issues. Now, if you look at, say, what do I have written down here? If you look at, say, the Golden Age, where villains were kind of black and white, and you gotta look at some of the things that were happening sort of from the 30s to the 50s. You have World War II.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You have the Great Depression. Yeah. What else did I have here? There was another good one in there. Great Depression. Oh, and no, that's definitely that's not it. Yeah, but anyway, World War II, Great Depression, things of that nature. So you have a very, I don't want to say blanket, but you kind of know that these things are bad. You know that you know what your enemy is. So I think that's how you get that sort of that black and white. Okay, it's Hitler. We know Hitler is bad. Let's put him on the screen. Let's have Captain America. Let's put him on the comic page. Let's have Captain America punch him. I have an interesting comparison about the Golden Age villains. So I'm going to put a pin on that. But also then let's jump to, say, the Silver Age. What do you have going on there? You have the Civil Rights Movement. You have Watergate scandal, Voting Rights Act of 1965. And then that was sort of when you saw a shift of complexity in villains. And also, especially with a lot of, you saw this especially in movies, there was sort of a shift in distrust in structures.
Yeah.
And sort of that's very much so speaking to a lot of the things that I mentioned in there, you know, and those sort of force our heroes to sort of look at those structures and look at those problems and have to react to that. Mm-hmm. You know, even pushing forward to the Killmonger. Before that, T'Challa, he never looked at any of these things. He never looked at what was going on with Black Americans. It was Wakanda was so much sanctioned off, and a lot of people have gone as far as to call T'Challa a conservative, but anyway, because they have
in a lot of comic runs, like most of them, if not.
Absolutely.
Oh, dude, wait till you read about the what's the circle, the circle group, the Illuminati,
in the comics. Dude, yeah,
he's like so evil.
What? That's why I was like, that's why I was like, imagine if, sorry, side tangent, but sorry,
side tangent.
Yeah, like I was like, imagine Spider-Man with knowledge of like the Illuminati as an older person, because he's a smart person and a thing, and just like having to come to grips with like the systemic things as Spider-Man, the character. I'm like, writing wise, he can do a lot especially as an older person.
As a person who's on the street level, this is what I.
That's what I'm saying.
NYC and Marvel is one of the best storytelling places ever. You got Fantastic Four. You have Tony Stark Industries. You have Spider-Man Uptown. One of the greatest locations ever written. So it's you have all these things going on. You got Daredevil in Hell's Kitchen.
Yeah,
it's so much going on, but they all experience different things.
Mm-hmm. We just need Marvel to show love and give us a Bronx superhero.
I was saying that as a resident of the Bronx, they definitely need to, because there's so much systemically, and just to kind of piggyback what you were saying between the different ages and eras, it's also a coinciding of who was telling the stories at the specific time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Like the amount of voices that became able to be comic book artists or people that came to love these characters at different times in history. I mean, you had Stan Lee writing for Fantastic Four in the beginning as he was like a younger person mm-hmm. and everything. But like, look at like what that meant when, you know, when he's younger trying to create Spider-Man, they're trying to discard him to, you know, a Miles Morales having went from an Ultimate Universe character to entering into the mainline series just from mm-hmm. popularity to having black writers actually write his stories for him. Mm-hmm. And it's just like the amount of progression between that, it speaks to the nature of the hero and the nature of the villains that came about, because I mean the intricacies between the relationship between a Miles Morales character versus a Prowler character is a depth that you can't, and speaks to a specific set of reality kind of like in the street level, but you know the different type of street level that justifies his existence as a character in general.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna finish my point. Is that but yeah, without Killmonger, T'Challa would have never. Especially the fact that Killmonger was created by his father. Mm-hmm. You know, he mm-hmm. never would have, or I can't say never, but it was a very low chance of him looking at the world and acknowledging those problems, and making an effort to go beyond the borders of Wakanda to make the world better.
Very interesting. And also for the movie too, the movie is Shakespearean, because it takes like a lot of the media that we get from like the postmodern era, from like the era where the first nuclear bomb is dropped to present.
Yes.
Right. A lot of the media that we talk comic is like comics in this modern iteration pretty much speaks to that reality. They break it up into the like the eras that you're saying, but it's like when you first read comics, you just see like, oh, how do we deal with this toxic goo? A lot mm-hmm. of it is a response to like nuclear age problems Absolutely. And going forward. And that's like the American mythology of being like the mm-hmm. first, the one in front, the one leading the pack in like the world stage level in the terms of the ways in which this mythologizing comics. But to bring it back to what I was saying before, just the way in which it's like a postmodern reality.
Yeah.
It's very interesting because like the, how do you say it? The hippie movement was pivoting off of like the
1870s. Golden Age 70s.
Yes, Golden Age 70s, right? But that was a nostalgic type of period from how people in the 1870s or 1860s used to have art and stuff like that. And so we have like these type of narratives that kind of transition from culture to culture to culture.
You know, it's crazy.
And
I'm
yeah.
sorry to cut you
off. No, you're good.
One of the greatest stories from the 70s that you just reminded me of was the Green Lantern X Green Arrow collab.
Yeah.
Where his Green Arrow's partner, Archie, mm-hmm. I forget his name, whatever, Red Robin, whatever the hell, he shoots up heroin. And
yeah.
Like they catch him, and it's like, wow, it's such a defining moment. It was one of the most important stories that I think came out right before they removed or after they removed the Comics Code Authority.
Yeah.
And it was just one of the ones that you could not tell at the time. It was like, wow.
Well, it was like, yeah, they're speaking to like actual problems. And it's just like, it's really cool because comics in itself is an intellectual medium. And I feel like with the ushering in of like comic book movies, people are taking it as such and just like breaking it down. And it's just a popularity. It's just like, this deserves dissection. But yeah, when you look at Killmonger, it's really just the story of, I forgot what the name of it. I'm going to pull up the Shakespeare story. But it's the same type of story as The Lion King. I forgot. I know which one. It's the same, but if you look at Lion King and you look at
was it Hamlet?
I believe it's Hamlet. But if you look at Lion King and Black Panther, they use the same Shakespearean type of storytelling where you have one brothers in arms on the opposite side, and it's a reflection of the storytelling to kind of push the villain and the hero within that type of archetype. So it's very interesting that, you know, something that that was written like the 1700s is very, like,
still apt. Relevant today.
Yeah, very apt and very relevant to the means of today.
And the best heroes are the ageless ones. They don't change masks and they don't change personalities. They are ideas.
Yes. So,
to you, Steven, who is your favorite supervillain of all time?
Oh, fuck. That's a big question.
Of all time.
I mean,
I could give you mine first.
If you
when I was younger, I remember I was 13, 14. I wasn't a big comics fan. I used to watch Comics Explains, Comics Extorting.
Yes.
You know, rest in peace. Rest in peace, Comic Story. I was a big fan. And I remember, like, being extremely young. And I was like, oh, man, one of my friends, he was like, yo, you should read this one. He pulls out God Loves, Man Kills. I was not ready. If you don't know what that is.
Which one?
God Loves, Man Kills is an X-Men story. It starts off with these two black kids. And I forget the name of the group, but I'm going to call them the Martians. We're going to call them the Martians. Why not? They're the Martians. And they run up on these two black kids while they're in the playground. And they shoot them to death.
Wow.
Yep. Like, that's just the start of the story. They string them up and call them muties. Like, literally put a tag on them.
Wow.
And it's an allegory for race, obviously. But yeah, Magneto finds them. And he swears, like, yo, whoever did this is going to get got. And it was one of the best stories to ever happen. And it's perfect. How, and it's a beautiful start to the story. So, like, the first 8 pages, beautiful, beautiful. And this is what I love Magneto about, because you were forced to watch one tragedy. He's the last guy to let another one happen. So, yeah. If anything leans in towards the sector of the Holocaust or even moves to it, it's like he's on it. He's like, I've seen this before. They start moving us in camps for our own good. They start watching our diet, start putting locking us up inside a cage, separating us, and then, you know, this is how it works, you know. And they start to define you as subhuman. They start to tell you, hey, keep an eye out for these people in your neighborhood, you know.
Yeah,
allegory for race and allegory for class and allegory.
Yeah, the X-Men is probably like the most like the best series to really attack that. And it also, on the meta level, like, it was created in, like, what, the 80s or 90s and stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's like when these pop, the 80s. And so, like, these topics are really kind of played or kind of baked into the nature of the team of the characters. And just, I guess we could kind of restructure, like, the conversation between, like, how can we look at, like, Professor Xavier and how does Magneto push Professor Xavier as, like, a character? In just general, and I'll kind of leave that open to, like, the table.
We gotta remember, I'm sorry to reflect, I want to get to this guy Trent real quick in a second, but we gotta remember in one of the 90s story, I forget the name of it, but they work together in Onslaught. Professor Xavier is mind controlled and he puts on Magneto's armor and he gives in to Magneto's philosophy. So even then, there are cracks in his barrier, Professor X's, where he does think, you know, maybe this guy is right, maybe it's over, maybe we have to. And that's what it is. A beautiful story. It's a beautiful story. But yeah, you've probably seen Onslaught before. But go ahead, Trent.
Yeah, I've seen Onslaught before. No. I was going to say Magneto and Xavier are two sides of the same coin. Once again, that what we talked about earlier, that separation of hero and villain.
Yeah.
It's, you know, same principles, same ideas, same goal. To an extent.
Yes.
Because Magneto's like, yo, let's get rid of him. Fuck them all. But no. Yeah. It's just how you go about it. And I think it's unfortunate that, you know, Magneto, he, in his lifetime, he's just been pushed just a little bit further than Charles Xavier. You know, he's a Holocaust survivor. So he's seen evil firsthand, you know, and he is at his limit when it comes to people persecuting mutants. Two sides of the same coin. That's their relationship. They offer a view into what it's like on the other side to each other, I think. You know, where would I be if I was a little more peaceful, or where would I be if I took it that further step.
Do the ends justify the means, and do the means justify the ends?
I think that's the question that's supposed to be constantly asked. For which side? it's a tough one because, you know.
It's interesting because it's just like how, for the heroes, like how much evil do you have to see until you either turn or you triumph? Mm-hmm. And for the villain, it's like how much evil are you going to pervade unless you until you change your ways? Or are you just going to let the evil that you've seen be the factor that determines who you are as a person?
That reminds me of that, like, that pretty famous, you know, quote or saying that goes around that people these days kind of meme about, but it really does make you think. And the phrase goes, you either die a hero or you live long enough to see yourself become the villain.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good thing. I think the kind of main thing that I juggle with that question a lot in terms of, like, just life, like how you may see somebody that has like an idea maker trying to do this, like, and how that can lead to like a corruption of like a person. And not even in the superhero world, but just in the world of just like, oh yeah, like let's say for instance Elon Musk, oh wow, we love that, we loved how this person was doing this, that, and the third. But then when you really evaluate it and you just keep on letting power, it's just like power always corrupts. And so you see portions where it's just like, all right, I'm gonna get rid of these things, but it kind of goes into what you're saying. So when I say get rid of these things, I'm talking about like the ways in which he talks, uses the Doge department and the advisory committee to get rid of the executive branch. I know I'll date the podcast, but speaking to the current, but it's more so to the point of what I was watching a political theorist say. He was talking about the American kind of nature of wanting to be left alone as like the prime driver of this. And so it kind of reflects on like Hulk as like a kind of hero and how that turns into like, what is Hulk kind of trauma and ability as a character, as he's not really seen as hero or villain, but kind of just exists as both, as like not really an anti-hero, he just exists as a creature of things.
One of the most beautiful told story, the Incredible Hulk, back in 2003 2004, I can't remember it,
but
not the one with Mark Ruffalo, the other one, the other guy.
Edward Norton.
He, that story is so great. I feel like it represents the character in the film medium in such a great way, because not only do you find that this man, he has a demon inside of him, but he also he chooses not to feed into it, and it's capable of so much destruction. He's always on the limit. He's always on the time barrier, because we all crash. We all mentally become taxed and told.
We all have limits.
You know, and his are just more destructive than ours. And I think it's a beautiful manifestation of how in society, like how we said crashing out last week.
But I just think like, because he was really inspired by that kind of, like I was saying, like, a lot of last era's literature kind of informs a lot of the American mythology. So a lot of like Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, kind of like the flip-flopping between the dualistic nature of a person and the good and evil and the wolfie fee type of mentality. Between like the wolfie fee being like an indigenous man's tale of, you know, you have two wolves, one of good and one of bad, and really it's the one that you foster, the one that you feed, is the one that speaks to who you are as a person. And it's just like, that also informs the ways in which we tell stories with heroes and villains too. And it's just like, which wolf have they feed? How have they trained this wolf to do this type of thing? How does this kind of manifest as a character in general? And it's like, it's very interesting to see the different lines and the different ways in which writers use these characters to tell a different story. Because let's say, for instance, you go to the Green Goblin and how the Green Goblin is used. So, and he's like an agent of chaos in a lot of early works.
Yes.
But it's just like reevaluating the agent of chaos. So when you have a movie like Far From Home, and it's like talking about the rehabilitation of villains, and that's like the main kind of story focus of like Spider-Man trying to actually make a difference, rehabilitate his villains, actually take the critiques that we love all at Batman, like, why are we beating up these villains if we're not systemically making these changes? and really putting it to the driver of Spider-Man as a character. And it's just like he ends up having to kill Green Goblin at the end. And it's just like, but not really kill him, but
Having to hold back,
rehabilitate himself because he was about to go.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just like reaching that critical limit, but still not crossing that threshold. And it's just like, you know, Green Goblin wasn't able to be rehabilitated. So it's just like, and some nature of evil is still pervasive. Like all the other heroes were able to, but just reevaluating the Ages of Chaos, and maybe chaos is inherent to every system. And it's just like, all right, if I know that that's the case, then what sacrifices am I willing to take? And that's like another angle.
What's the limit? What is, and that's why I was just questioning myself earlier today. I was like, to what effort is change, like to what limit is your own survival worthy of great change?
Yeah.
How much do you depend on yourself and your own maybe livelihood, job, regardless, your survival, how much does that outweigh the actual change we bring into the world?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'm not a crazy person, but I'm like, dude, what if I just start, like, living that way? You know, because I used to go
one bad day away from that.
But yeah.
Like, what if I start living, like, you know, every day I got to bring some change into the world, but, like, on some positive, real Chance the Rapper stuff, like.
Yeah.
I had to say Chance the Rapper because, he's, you know, he's Christian. But, you know, I used to work at a soup kitchen for a little bit, and I was like, why haven't I went back? Why haven't, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, why am I scrolling Instagram right now? And this is also a guilt thing, you know, a little bit. But it's like, why not bring more good into the world? Why not do that? Just, it feels like the bare minimum sometimes.
Yeah.
And some of the best New York stories that also show the bare minimum is Daredevil. Daredevil
is amazing.
If you guys want a quick synopsis, was a kid. I don't know why those containers were not filled. He gets hit with radioactive
container. Yeah, they never give it. He was just hit with it,
and he goes blind. He becomes a lawyer known as Matt Murdock. But
I'm excited for the show.
My favorite, Born Again, is such a great comic. I think you should read it, though.
I'm so excited.
That panel when he's sitting there inside of the taxi. Spoilers, but dude, you're gonna see it. They better animate. I mean, that anime. They better
bring it to the live action.
Yes, he's sitting in the taxi. They drive him off the pier, and he's sitting at the bottom of the pier like the taxi cab. He opens up his eyes and he slims out, just like angry at Kingpin, which is one of the greater villains in Marvel Comics. Yeah. Kingpin is a reflection of how the law could be used and manipulated by great men. Matt Murdock is a lawyer. He defends the innocent. He protects people.
Yeah.
And even though he goes out at night and beats up people with batons and sticks, he tries his best. He's a man of God. He's a Christian. He puts people first. Versus Kingpin, he uses the law against it. He's a mafioso, a bad man, a mobster. He uses all his power, but he keeps people in check. Even though he's evil, look what I've done for the community. Especially in recent ones where he works with the X-Men. He's like, look what I've done for your community. Look what I've done for you guys. Look what I've done for everybody.
And he's like, it's just a proud, like, the best thing about Kingpin and the writing that they do is that in every system, you have power brokers, places where power tends to accumulate.
Yes.
And it's like, you can't necessarily get rid of that as your first step. You can't get rid of like the main structural support when trying to rework how a building works. You're just going to cause a collapse.
Rehabilitation.
And it's just like, exactly. And it's just like a measure, because even in the Spider-Man games, they try to take Kingpin out, and then you had new heroes trying to fill the void. And that speaks to the nature of, you know, the original thing that we're talking about with like the golden era, with, you know, heroes and villains, one being an agent of order and one being an agent of chaos. And as we go through time, it speaks to the varying complexities of what that means, in the sense that, like you were saying, Daredevil and Kingpin, they're both agents of the law and lawfulness. Mm-hmm. But it's just like, at what ends and in what ways do the two power dynamics butt heads? And it's just like, one is a power broker that's just trying to keep in check while self-enriching, while one is trying to, you know, actually get to the source of crime. One is trying to actually prevent these things. And then sometimes going above the law. And, you know, the nature of superheroes and villains is that, you know, some of them, or most superheroes, exist as a vigilante.
Yes.
And the nature of vigilanteism is like, I think, a huge kind of like story point as we go forward in the kind of aging of comics and heroes and villains, because now we live in a world where, let's say, you have a Luigi Mangione,
yes,
and the way in which that vigilanteism facilitates and creates itself versus the vigilanteism of a Daredevil or something like that, and the veneration of a hero, and what does that mean at for somebody that is not really like his same type of Daredevil Kingpin situation, just in a real world scenario.
And to relate that to, let's move from the Golden Age to the Silver Age, to one of the greater Daredevil villains, Punisher.
Yeah,
who has been done justice in this show.
And that show is amazing.
Beautiful show. Frank Castle is a man of no second chances. He doesn't get any. He goes to prison, comes out, his family's killed.
Yeah.
Bomb. Boom. That's it. No second chances. And he comes out, and even in the show, they quote this from the comics, he says to Daredevil, "You hit them, and they get back up. I hit them, and they stay down." It's how they approach criminals.
I sent you that clip.
Yes.
No, you watch the show. Watch Daredevil. Watch Punisher, please. It's on Netflix.
Everybody. Those were the best two shows out of the whole
series. It's actually on Disney Plus now. Not that we're getting money from any of them. But yeah, if they want to send some bucks our way, please.
Please.
For a sponsor?
But yeah, moving back to the Silver Age, you know, Punisher was at first a Spider-Man villain, you know.
A lot of Daredevil's rogue gallery actually comes from Spider-Man, and is just trying to take on a more realistic take of it, which is really, like, Kingpin was originally, like, was Spider-Man's villain.
Yeah.
And then he just meant, that's why I love that Spider-Man and Daredevil are getting more collaboration spotlight, because they're both very, very similar and very distinct, and I like that. For the hero writing and the villain writing for both their shared rogues gallery, it takes aspects of the hero and just brings it to its logical conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Where does this vigilanteism comes from? It takes it to its logical conclusion and it becomes a character. And it's just like, all right, that becomes Punisher, right?
Yes.
And it's just like, okay, where does this kind of like power broker and kind of accumulation of power kind of, you know, the power... with great power comes great responsibility, and even though it wasn't said by Uncle Ben in the comic, just like that little blurb, and you know, that facilitates into a Kingpin type of character, and how does that kind of fester? And it's just very interesting that while we're talking about like nature of villains, that like we said before, it's not like the villain really kind of is born out of nothing. It's like it stems from the character or from the system itself.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, Steven, back to you. I'm sorry to cut you off.
You're good. You're good.
But, Steven, I let you rot with it for a few. I'm not going to let you sleep. Who is your greatest supervillain of all time, and how do you feel like they connect to this?
Yeah.
So, I only recently got into comics. I was never really super into them, but I kind of... Yeah.
Once again, we don't have to stick to, comics.
Yeah,
you can pick, pull from whatever. Medium you want,
but also kind of like saying like I'm finally into comics a little bit. I just started reading Green Lantern because he's my favorite DC hero, and I'm really digging it so far. Not my favorite villain, but Sinestro is amazing as a character. Love him.
Yeah.
But from like a raw aura standpoint, and even though I haven't like we haven't really seen much of him in the most recent like MCU run yet, but I'm very excited for it. But like in other media that I've seen him in, and it's already been mentioned. Dr. Doom, man.
Dr. Doom
is just like the epitome. Like when you think of Thanos, you think of like, you know, that cataclysmic endgame and all that happened. But like even the mention of Dr. Doom like sends like shivers down your spine because of like what you know he's done, what he is going to be bringing to, you know, the MCU when he's finally introduced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think he is like top tier super villain for me.
Yeah.
In that regard.
And how do you feel like he has changed over time?
Yeah, he's been an amazing character. Aside from like the two movie renditions where he's like really bad, like every other rendition of him has been amazing. Phenomenal. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not gonna lie, most of my knowledge of him does come from the crappy movies. Well, the first one, which
the first one was pretty decent. Yeah,
it was also it wasn't bad. And I mean, except for the end where they like you know beat him by making him hot and then cold again. That was kind of stupid.
Yeah, that was,
in my opinion, that was.
That's how I beat my villains. I make them hot and I make them cold.
So
I
give him some ice.
I give him that Shock sponsorship. That little bit of icy hot. Call it a day. I lost another sponsor for us.
But another amazing villain in the MCU that I love was Ultron.
Ultron was amazing too.
Oh my god! In the movies, Ultron was great, but like there was also my favorite moment for Ultron actually didn't come in one of the mainstream movies. It came in the What If series, and that was when it was the What If situation where Thanos won. And you know, took over everything, and it was all copacetic. He's standing there. He's like, you know, all the Avengers are dead. He's taken over the world or the universe or whatever. And he's just standing there. And then like a portal opens up, and Vision steps through. Mm-hmm. And you know, Thanos turns him and is like raises the gauntlet, and then literally Vision just slices him in half. and then fades into Ultron, and then Ultron grabs the gauntlet and the Infinity Stones and starts going crazy.
Because Vision was originally a body met for Ultron. Yeah.
And like that moment, that even though it was a what if, that was freaking crazy.
Yo, what if is like as far as like favorite MCU shows, they're my that's my favorite MCU show. That I've been asking for a what if. Well, I wanted a movie originally, but I'll take a show in animated form because. Yeah. When I saw the first Avengers movie, I was like, "Yo, we need a what if?" Because on tangent time, so like they used to be this website called Tumblr.
I still
use it. There's some secret projects out there if y'all can find it. You can't though.
Damn,
that's where they first started like race and gender swapping the Avengers because the Avengers was fucking huge, and I was like, "Yo, like that's a very great basis for what if? Like, what if?" Because they were using like actual actors, and they were just like placing them where all these male actors were. And I was like, "That's a great basis for the what if series. What if you take this actor, you take this woman, or you take this black person, and you know switch them out?" Because I mean, it's all essentially it's all the same, you know, just the flavor is a little different, you know, because we are all the same. But anyway, that's it. I'm done with that tangent.
I mean they did something similar with like what if Penny Parker was Penny Parker's Spider-Man. What's Captain America's love interest? I forgot her name.
Peggy Carter.
Yeah,
sounds similar to Penny Parker.
I was thinking about the wrong thing.
Say them both 5 times fast. You can.
But like for her, they definitely made her in the What If series. I remember it.
Yeah. What if she actually?
She's
became...
been getting a little bit of a big push. She was in.
She was in Multiverse of Madness.
She was in Multiverse of Madness. And she got cut in half. Unfortunately.
She did get cut in half. That was her.
She got cut in half.
I mean, that Multiverse of Madness scene was so whack. I was just like, I liked it for the jokes, but it just had too much Deadpoolism. What felt like the earned type of like nature of that. I understand. I like Sam Raimi as an artist though. Yes. So I'm like, I love the end part of the scene. Like it created like genuine horror and fear, but it was just like, it was just,
you know,
it was just bad writing from just carryover projects.
I didn't like how that battle with Wanda and the Illuminati went
down.
How it went down, because like my biggest thing was like, oh, you know, first of all, you have Mr. Fantastic give away the secret of his like best fighter immediately. He's like, Black Bolt can kill you with a scream or whatever. Yeah. And Wanda's just like, all right, cool, no mouth. And then like this dude who has presumably the fortification of like a boulder to not ever speak because he knows like the ramifications of that, panics immediately and kills himself with his own voice.
Yeah, it was just like writing like the worst
character. It didn't make sense
in the comics. He literally grabs a knife, cuts his own mouth open when people try to do that. Like
he's known for like being able to do, because he knows that that's his like main weakness.
He's crazy. Like a lot of that group, I forget their name, but they're crazy.
I know what you're talking about.
The Inhumans.
Yeah.
You know, but no, I love, you know, I was high off of edible watching that film.
That's funny as hell.
One of the best things that I remember from Sam Raimi's, the direction he was trying to take it.
It was shot really well, too.
Crawling out of, I don't know if it's a portal or painting, but she's like, her body's twisting.
Yeah, no, yeah, it was genuine like, fear, wow. But
there
it was
were
just,
moments that were pretty scary in the movie. No, I'm not gonna lie.
Sam Raimi is good at that. Like, if you rewatch Spider-Man 2, the arms were very, very scary. Like, the way that they shot them, the way that they did the puppetry for them, amazing.
Oh, you're talking about Doc Ock?
Yeah, like, that, like the way, just like in retrospect. But the only thing, it was just like, it goes back to just the thing that you were critiquing before with like the MCU of like, if you watch WandaVision, some of the character decisions didn't make sense with the journey. Like, they could have told the same story, but certain key moments that they based the whole plot around just didn't make sense for the character having went through that journey. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to what you're saying about the hero journey. Like, if you're going to go back to the status quo, it's not the same status quo that you start with. Like, it's a new status quo, and so you have to change the fulcrum or the basis in which the hero has to resort to villainy or has a momentary lapse into that. And it was just like, it made no sense for Wanda to really reach that, aside from like, yes, the motivations were there, but it was just like the ways in which it was acted out, it was the how was like a missing question.
Yes, no, especially her taking captive of a whole town. That was a
It was like taking captive of a whole town, but you just did the WandaVision thing, like you just had it. Like, okay, the whole town. But Wanda is also, like, a very interesting character because she stems from X-Men origin. So the way that they brought her in the first time was very interesting and new. So they were still working out
with
the kinks.
Claw, yes.
Yeah, it was, like, the new type of kinks. But it was just, like, damn.
Yeah, it's unfortunate.
Missed opportunity.
I see you have something pulled up there, Trent. What is that?
What's up? Oh, no, this was, I was thinking about a different moment with the villain. But we can get into it.
Yeah, I'm ready.
We can
get
into it. I was just going to talk about my... So I have like two sort of responses to your question.
Yeah.
So my favorite, I would say, I don't necessarily have a favorite villain, all-time supervillain, but one of my favorite renditions of in the MCU of them making me care for a villain I really had that really wasn't on my radar before was Spider-Man: Homecoming and the Vulture. If you haven't seen it, he is essentially the Vulture is a he's a working man, you know, middle class. He runs a construction crew. It says crew essentially there when he starts his villain arc. They're, you know, cleaning up after the Battle of New York, and then of course the big guys come in. I want to say they belong to Stark Industries, but a bigger company comes and just takes over everything. And so he's out of a job. And so, you know, the guy's got to make ends meet. So he kind of goes into selling a lot of the things that they found and couldn't discard a lot of alien technology on the black market.
Yes.
You know, he's not necessarily an evil guy, but he's just trying to make a living for his family.
Yeah.
You know, very street villain, very Spider-Man. And he ends up, if you haven't seen it, he ends up having a connection to Spider-Man that's done fucking beautiful.
Oh, yeah. When you first seen that movie, it was amazing.
I was like, gasp.
Yeah. It was pretty crazy.
But no, there's another movie. It might be a little lesser known. Because I was thinking about this and I was like, what's one time very early on in, say, a movie where I've had an instant guttural reaction, like, I hate this person.
Oh.
And there's this movie called, Japanese movie called 13 Assassins. I don't know if anybody in here has ever seen
it. No, I haven't.
No? So essentially, you have this evil lord who's wreaking havoc in Japan, and these 13 samurai are enlisted to take him down. So if you watch the opening scene of the movie, like, it is just, it's so heartbreaking, but it's so simple. It's, you see the Lord, and this guy's like telling this story of how they were in the same vicinity as his the guy who's telling the story. The Lord was in the same vicinity as his son and his newly married wife, the Lord. I don't want to say his name because I'm going to butcher it. Matsudara, something. Anyway, we'll just stick with Lord M.
Yeah.
So Lord anyway, M. He comes across the newly married woman, and he's like essentially, he's like, I want her.
Okay.
So he grabs her by the hair, he takes her in the back, and he rapes her. Yeah.
Wow.
And he like the husband comes in and, you know, you see the Lord just sitting there very casual. And he refers to her as a monkey. And he was like, yeah, the women on in this region are very much like monkeys. That's crazy. They scratch a lot. And then so the husband goes to comfort her. Immediately, he just stabs the husband with a sword, treats it like it's nothing. He's like, oh, you're a monkey, too. And like the way he's disrespecting these people and treating human life, it like really makes you
subhuman.
Yeah, it really makes you like, I hate this motherfucker. And then there's another scene yeah. where you see the aftermath of something else he's done to a woman, which I won't spoil it. You got to see it. I would it agree. Was like, yo, it's yeah. over. This guy has to go. And I was like, I don't care who you get, but I'm with him. Let's yeah. get it. Like yeah. that was... One What's of up? The war- okay. I thought you were about to say something. But yeah, no, that was very... when I was thinking about villains, that was one of... what was that, 2010 I said? Yeah, that was one time I was like, yo, like that was a very great way to start a movie and to get you to hate someone. And I'm sorry, what were you about to say?
The subhumanization of other people is one of the scariest things that you could write about. Yeah, absolutely. When done right... To make a person not feel comfortable in their own body is something Facts. That is so hard to do, regardless if it's sexual assault, it's abuse, if it's something just as simple as ignoring them sometimes.
Absolutely.
Just not yeah. even giving them the peace of mind. It's something that, when done right, could really just bring a story and make it almost personal. Because we all have felt ignored. We all have felt unseen before. Yeah. And it's something that... I feel like it's done great in Ooh. The Dark Knight Returns. One of my greatest Joker stories of all time. I'm sorry to bring the segue.
Yeah, no, you're good.
Steven, what is your favorite Joker story before I go in?
Oh my God, I don't even know. I don't know. I was never... Great. Okay, listen. This is going to be a possibly controversial opinion.
Yes.
Probably not controversial opinion. Like I said, I haven't read comics up until very recently. Mm-hmm. I cannot stand... The DC movies.
Oh no! That film is not. Here's what it is. For me personally, Heath Ledger set such a high bar. Unfortunately, that will never be surpassed, and people cannot let go. It is. He is one of the best artists. I mean, like not even an actor, an artist to ever live, and he'll never like the way he set up the acting and the way the film is almost written. It's like it was made to cater to him.
Almost. Yeah.
Yeah, his level he was great in that movie. Like that, I guess that if I had to pick one like of the greatest Jokers that like yes. I managed to like see would definitely be that one. But like in regards to like just how the DC universe went about doing their movies, I just think they did it in the exact like Marvel clear cut plan. Yes. Phase one, boom. Phase two, boom. Mm-hmm. Phase three, boom. Clear cut, great. Love it.
That's why they suffer right DC, now. They have no plan.
DC was like, we got Batman, we got Superman. We're going to go with those as long as we can. Then we're going to go throw everything else in a blender, turn the lights off, and hope shit doesn't fly everywhere.
Yes.
Yeah. That's the thing with the cinematics. That it was just very cash grabby because everybody was just like, oh yeah, let's do this. And I kind of wanted to, one, speak to what makes... A badly written villain. Ooh. I feel like that's a very good question.
Modern Joker. I'm going to bring it back to Joker. I love The Dark Knight Returns. It's one of the best stories ever written. It's why it got me into comics. You know, it's an older Joker.
Epitome of Agent of Chaos.
You know, he's older. He's just come out of... Now, he was in Arkham for a long time. And he comes out. He's sitting on his talk show. They think he's rehabilitated.
Yeah.
They think... And as soon as he sits down, he says, I'm going to kill everybody in this room. Gas. Gas is the whole room. Wow. And he kills everybody. And at the end of the story, you know, him and Bruce Wayne is in the Tunnel of Dark. You know, Bruce Wayne has to put the suit back on because he's older. Mm-hmm. And he snaps his own neck, you know, mm-hmm. making it look like Batman killed him. So now not only did he cause the end of Batman, but he caused it in a way to where he's the new villain. He can never return.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I like that Joker is like the epitome. Joker and Green Goblin, for both respective, comic book houses, yes. Represent like the purest kind of distillation of Agent of Chaos. And what does that mean for like a character? So it's just like finding new ways to just kind of pervade in like the, be just that antithesis, more so Joker than Goblin. But how to be like the antithesis of like what it symbolizes to even be a hero in this type of world.
What is evil? What do we consider evil in the modern world? And what has been evil before? Now, one of the stories I would say back to Joker is The Killing Joke, where he...
That one is amazing. That
Barbara
one
is... while shooting her in the waist. Mm-hmm. And he kidnaps what's his name? Commissioner Jim Gordon, yes.
That one was Jim Gordon,
and he tries to push him over his limit, and... I'll never forget when he opens up and he's talking to the man to buy the old carnival, and he's like, oh, well, why would you want to buy this rusty dump? It's dirty. It's horrible. He's like, no, I see something in here. And you just his mind work. He's like, oh, I could make somebody snap in here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was just the way I think The Killing Joke is probably one of the best. I know it's still like it's very cliche to say like it's one of the best ones, but it really shows like the depravity of like the metric, the ways in which Joker would. I think Joker works best when he's trying to prove a point and does it by any means.
Yes.
And, like, that's when he's written to the best. Like, even in The Dark Knight, it wasn't really... Like, it was just a means to just be the foil to Batman. And what that was a whole fulcrum of, like, the film. Like, he didn't even need the money. Yes. Like, he burns the money. The money stack and is like, I'm just here just to cause antagonism. And it's, like, same with The Killing Joke. It was just, like... How can I make Batman see that, you know, it really only takes one day? And so he kidnaps Commissioner Gordon's daughter, who turns into Oracle as a result, shoots her.
Yes.
Sadly, like, the SAs her and just, like, really pushes Jim Gordon to, like, the really end. And they leave the panel at the point where you can't even tell if Batman really kills him or not.
He's so scary.
And it just leaves a really... haunting type of feeling even just talking about it. And it's just like, what is the nature of evil? How does that kind of pervade as like a villain, and how does that suit the storytelling of the stories that you try to tell?
In the modern day, we had a story that came out recently, I'm not gonna say 2 to 3 years ago, but they actually had unwritten out the canon, that's how bad it was. Wow. Where they get all three of the Jokers from the Golden Age to the Bronze Age to the Modern Age, where the Modern Age one is more known for cutting off his face.
Yeah.
Don't get me started. I thought it was nice when it first came out, but I was like, oh no, not really.
Sometimes writers go too far just to be extreme, just for the sake of being extreme. Edgy. Like, what? Yeah, just to be edgy.
It helps you stand out.
And, you know, and the thing is about being a villain. I don't think the modern Joker is a villain. I don't think modern Joker is evil anymore. I think he just does things.
Yeah, that's
the problem. There's you have to write a villain, not an impulsive psychopath.
And for me, that's to answer that question, that's what makes a bad film. Cause like if your villain is just there to just do stuff because it's bad or because he's the bad guy, that's for me a bad villain. It's completely two dimensional. It's like classic light versus dark, where there's no mixture, there's no muddle, there's no like, you know, is this right, is this wrong? It's just completely flat, and that is the worst kind of villain to me.
Yeah, and I piggyback, like, even not to say that the Golden Age villains were necessarily bad, because like they weren't very intricate in thought, but they served their purpose. Like the mustache twirling man just really wanted to see like this woman die, and it was just like the depravity of that is crazy in itself, but you don't need a whole bunch of explanation, it's and that honest. Doesn't make it yeah it's honest sometimes for the sake of being edgy, or just the nature of trying to appeal to, you know, people's worst types of imaginings of what evil is, and just try to paint it as an act and make it seem like, you know, evil is just a static thing. Evil is very dynamic, and like good, it changes and it morphs, and it tries to be the lack or corruption of what is good in a system. And so like from that point, if you don't really acknowledge that or kind of go from that standpoint, you're kind of at a loss, because then you just have characters just doing stuff just to do stuff, because it's really just a war of ideas.
Because evil is not an action, it's the stages that get you there.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think that's a part of it too.
Damn,
he's been.
That was good.
He said, "I'm coming back prepared. I am ready for this."
This man said he was nervous.
You ate this whole. Like, can we get a Wilhelm? That should eating this shit up.
Facts.
Oh man. What were you gonna say?
No. Go ahead.
I was just loving on Wilhelm. My fault. Wilhelm is like that extra scream in the middle of it. That's just this one dude that says,
He's the unseen member.
Him yeah. Oh, speaking of the unseen, ooh. I think that would be like an amazing title for the episode. But also an awesome MF Madlib album. And the unseen in general, I think that from that point, you can kind of distill where heroes and villains kind of stem from.
Yes.
From that point of like being the unseen. Mm. And that's like where they kind of stem from. And somebody said it earlier, but I wanted to bring it up. But the unseen, or just the lack of, inspires both the hero and the villain in a lot of ways. And it's just like, that's why they're two sides of the same coin. And when you acknowledge that, and as we kind of push narrative forward, what does it mean to be unseen? Or is the unseen even something that can't exist anymore? Like, imagine in the current where we have like issues with like surveillance capitalism, or the ways in which we're being surveilled via our phone products, yes. Or this, is there really, what is the unseen? What is the unseen, and how does that create heroes and villains in our current environment? And how does that push the nature of narrative forward? And how do we engage with the unseen things of the medium itself? How do we make it meta-contextual? How do we deal with, maybe in the 30s it was disperspective writing, and now we acknowledge that. How do we see that part that just seems as a default and view that as the unseen and push the narrative forward? And that's why, like, I really love the ways in which, you know, mediums like comics, or the mediums like just the nature of writing, you can get to asking like the whys to things. And I think every story, the best stories ask why, and then the worst stories just do.
Yes, the demons stay in the dark because they are afraid of the light.
Yeah.
When you say, what was the word you used?
The unseen.
The unseen, do you mean the other?
It could be the other too, okay. But I'd say just the unseen. Like, unseen just being the lack, because let's say, for instance, you know, Peter Parker is unseen in the beginning. He's very, like, lowly, is a geek, is a nerd, is an outcast. And so it is a part of otherization, but it's, like, the quiet battles that are not necessarily portrayed via the character as they assume the hero kind of role.
The unheard.
Yeah, like the unheard, the unseen, just the, it's just like that prefix of, yeah. Just like, maybe that creates that kind of otherization, but it's not just that. It's just that this is not them. This is a system-wide thing. Mm. Like, this is an archetype for him to inhabit to become a hero. So let's take even the nature of comics. Like, the nature of comics was a medium of the unseen to, you know, a lot of people just being like, oh, you're a nerd, or you're a geek, or you're this person. But then when it becomes like the highest selling commodity, selling billions and trillions of dollars of revenue for becoming the most popular products, it's now a matter of like, oh, you didn't acknowledge my existence when I didn't serve you. Now it's just like, now you acknowledge my existence because I'm popular. And it's like, what does that mean for the medium? Is that why the medium struggles now? Where are the ways in which the things are unseen now? And then you have narratives in which villains in media in general, like, if you ever seen Everything Everywhere All at Once.
I want to so bad. Yeah. I have not seen it yet.
I won't spoil it, but just the nature of what it means to be unseen in that. How does that launch the main antagonist in that movie, in particular with the daughter? And how does that create villains and heroes in the same time? And it's just like, how do you follow a protagonist to acknowledge the unseen?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, because there is, like, although it's not as well-received of a superhero movie, there is a specific one in which that kind of is the driving point of the antagonist. And that, I think, is it's one of the Spider-Man movies, the one with Electro.
Where he
goes through his life, and, you know, he's like unseen. He's just this guy. He's you know, in a lab. Spider-Man 2. Amazing Spider-Man 2. He's this guy in a lab. He is unassuming. He doesn't have much going on. No one pays attention to him. He's unseen. But then, as soon as something goes down, that's when he finally becomes part of, in the spotlight. And
yeah, he gets a little bit of power.
Exactly, and yeah. it's a really good look at what power can do to those kind of people. Like, when you spend so long in the dark, what is that little bit of light going to truly reveal?
It's like Plato's allegory of the cave. It's the just cave, like, yeah, looking at the cave, like shadows and shit. And it's just like, all right, but like when you get brought into the world, you can either retreat back to the cave or, you know, mm-hmm,
exactly,
evolve as a person.
Let's even take apart where his first fight was, in the middle of Times Square, where all the light is, mm-hmm, electricity, city of lights, screens, city, well, of lights, ads, everything. All this light, he gets power from electricity. Mm-hmm. All this light surrounds him, yet he is still unseen. Everybody flees. It's empty.
Yeah.
It's just him and his opposite.
Yeah, and it's funny because, remember, Peter Parker starts from that situation. So it's just like one of the things that he doesn't really acknowledge is that, you know, we don't see it as the audience because the narrative itself kind of structures it as like, oh, this is a very two-dimensional type of argument. Yes. But if you really want to make it very three-dimensional, if you really were to attack Peter Parker's vigilantism, Peter Parker is very unseen still in, mm-hmm, his life at that moment. And it's just like, if they really push, if you push the narrative to be like, there's a lot more similarities between the way that Electro deals with being unseen and the power that is assumed by Peter turning into Spider-Man, as opposed to the default power that now Electro is forced to possess at all times.
Yes.
And how you can deal with, like, hey, Peter, you get to hide behind the mask.
In a more competent movie.
In a more competent movie, you could have, like, Peter, you hide behind the mask, but I have to live like this for the rest of my life.
And not only that, but you chose to be Spider-Man.
Yeah, you chose this.
You had a choice. You were in the right place at the right time. I was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Exactly. And it's just like, speaking from, like, a writing standpoint, like, those are the questions that really lead to good storytelling.
Yes.
Mm. When you ask, what is the question not being asked? What is the unseen in this kind of dichotomy too?
I get you.
And that's goes back to what I was saying before. Like, that's what kind of makes a bad villain. When you kind of just frame it as just like, there's no meta argument. When you don't really look at the argument before the argument that's happening. Like, what sets up the type of forces that oppose each other? Like, if I set up this magnet, why am I even setting up this magnet to do this test?
Yes.
Why? When you ask that why, you're like almost 70% to like a good story. Like, even in the narrative that you're talking about, why tell a story between the classes of like reds and blues and things of that nature? Because it speaks to real life notions of class, real life notions of race. And so when I put it in this thing, I can work out the power differences. So now I'm coming from the standpoint of, now this kind of power dynamic pushes and ebbs and flows and gives me a good story.
I think that's honestly the best thing that most people don't realize about storytelling is most people read or consume media, whatever, you know, consume stories in order to escape some type of thing. But more often than not, in their efforts to escape, they find their way back to themselves,
yes,
in a way that they never would have looked at before.
Yeah.
Because all storytelling is a way for us to understand ourselves.
Yes, exactly.
And that's why I love it so much and whatever medium it consumes. And that's also like why I really take umbrage with people who, you know, may look at a story that, you know, they're like, oh, this is too political. This is too this. This is too that. You're missing the point entirely. That is what these are supposed to be. They're supposed to be an escape, but they're also supposed to be your magnifying glass into the world around you so that you can critically think about what's going on. Society could feed you, you know, different things all this time. Eat this, buy that, you know, look at this. But what it's the stories that make you truly look into yourself that you need to pay attention to, because all that other stuff is just meant to distract.
Yeah.
And when you're distracted, you're compliant.
Yes.
And I'm getting real deep here, so I'm going to stop.
Have you ever seen They Live?
Have you seen what?
They Live.
They Live is a good one, too.
Okay. I'm not going to get into it because we're running out of time.
Yeah. Good movie, though.
I was just, that was a very interesting point about being unseen, because that was sort of...
That was the whole fulcrum of the movie.
No. That was... no, absolutely. But it was that comment that I, that point that I put a pin in, it kind of touched on that a little bit, and I'm gonna say this and get your thoughts, and then we're gonna close off the episode. Hey, but
full circle.
So I when I was looking at, you know, a lot of these older eras and the newer era, and specifically when I was thinking about the Dark Knight Joker, I saw a sort of, I saw this interesting comparison. So the biggest, one of the biggest connections between the Joker and Batman in that movie, The Dark Knight, is they are two characters, and in some senses, symbols that are incorruptible, and thus they are also other. Mm-hmm. They're not like everybody else. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the most interesting things about sort of the modern and the postmodern era. But even more interesting, when you go back in time to one of the earlier eras, they also use the other.
Yeah.
But they use it in a different way. They sort of looked at this idea of the unknown and kind of put a xenophobic twist on it. You know, like we, you know, they're going back to, you know, the Red Scare, or, you know, just different, just different things like that. Like, you know, it was, or you have these monsters that we don't understand, Creature from the Black Lagoon, things like that.
Yeah.
And I thought it was really interesting to see how we use other now, as opposed to how we use other then. It was just really interesting. I don't want to get you guys' thoughts on that before we close it out. The other as a villain.
I think most fears tie to the cycle of death and having finality. And I think the other and, you know, evil kind of are symbolized with that, are like very tangential to that kind of point of like, what is a threat to my self-perseverance as a thing? And it's just like, you know, other threats. So when you grow up, you see another person, it's like, this person could help me, or this person could demolish my life. And so you have a baked-in fear of the other instinctually, or just the other environment. If this is not a part of me, this environment can kill me. And so that broadens into the fear of the unknown, what else is out there. And it's also just kind of like the nature of human curiosity to want to explore too. And make more things known so you have less to worry about. And then that pervasive kind of like fear-based inclination creates a lot of problems. And it's like we're always trying to figure out ways in which, you know, that is playing a part into our demise or playing a part into our successes in life. Like, oh yeah, we explored space, we explored the deep sea, look at this, right? Natural curiosity for the positive. Oh man, look at how we looked over here and we created this disease. How do we became the agent of our own chaos, our own demise? And it's kind of like the main thing about storytelling, like you were saying, is just we're just the universe kind of exploring itself and just playing out scenarios to really understand self.
I like that, man. That was great. Yeah, I love that. The universe playing with itself.
Yeah.
Whoa.
No, but I mean, yeah.
Hey, kinky universe.
I mean, if no one else has anything to add, I'm gonna close it on that because I thought that was.
Let me get one.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
We take from the past to create something new in the present to build something great for the future. It's in a world so costly to be blind. One must always open up their eyes to perspective. These heroes are not just a lens, like Steven said, or a magnifying glass, as you said. They are a viewpoint in certain places where sometimes we'll never go or we'll never experience.
Facts.
But just please keep an open mind wherever you go.
Yeah.
That's all I ask. Thank you.
Yeah.
Mari has spoken.
Eat it up.
Any final thoughts?
I think on the subject of the other, in modern day and modern time, the other is used as like fear or scare tactics, because in modern day, what the agenda that is trying to be pushed by so many people is this other version of this unknown version of like, oh, we don't know what these trans people are doing. We don't know what this country is doing. And it's this way of trying to keep everybody scared.
Fear-based politics.
Exactly. Yes. And I think the more attention we bring to it, the more we try to bring that other into the light and learn from it, the more connected and informed we can be as a society. Because the more something is kept in the dark, in the dark, the more it's going to coalesce and writhe and build until this big bad thing. Like, an idea like that isn't scary until it gets fed and you feed it by, you know, crap, I lost my shelf.
No, you're good.
And you feed it by, like, you know, by giving into it. And so the best thing you can do is peer in and try to take that little bit of step into what if this other thing isn't what everybody else is saying.
Yes.
And just by being inquisitive, but just by being introspective, just by setting that little tiny bit of light into that pool of darkness, you might not see that that pool goes as deep as you're told.
Yeah.
Hey, ooh,
to piggyback off of that, I will say that I heard this thing, and it talks about how nostalgia and fascism are intertwined.
Damn.
And it's just like, nostalgia, if you know about it, it can happen for times that you experience and times that have never happened. So with the way in which we write and tell stories, it's very interesting to look at the rise of authoritarianism across the globe and look and ask, what is the unseen detriment of nostalgia? And that's, yeah.
All right, I'm not going to add on to that.
And to add on to that.
Yo, shout outs, thank yous. We're going to start with Mars, since he's been firing.
I appreciate this episode. Having me on here. I feel like I did great today.
Episode of the decade.
No, I'm going to leave this one thinking, is the other a perspective or is it a idea that is unseen?
Ooh. How's that a thank you?
I think it could be both.
I think it could be both.
Hey. Part two.
Maybe. These things always end up being more than they really are.
Always. Like you said, that's the nature of the show. But I'm sorry. But no. Yeah. Shout out.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me on.
Thank you to Trent and Sage for bringing me back again.
Yeah, it's always
this
welcome.
Is great. Love it. This is your third time, right? Yeah, two-parter and then this. Yeah. And of course, as always, thank you to my amazing wife at home right now, who brought baked goods for everybody.
I'm excited.
So yeah, we can't eat them in here, but you know, afterwards.
Exactly. Yes. Do the rules.
And my dog Hubble, I love him, and I will give him a bunch of pets when I get home.
That's such an amazing name. Thank yous. Thank you, good nature souls. Exist altruistic. That's all I'm gonna say.
Thank you all, everyone who's in attendance. And thank you, Derek, who was not on mic for this episode.
Yeah, we're here live.
Today's episode was recorded in front of a live studio audience.
Yes.
Thank you, Stan Lee. But also thank you. Yes, thank
shout
you, Stan
Lee.
Excelsior. Thank you to all the writers, you know, all the people in positions of power who create these mediums, who dare to, you know, push the narrative forward when it comes to villains and give us things that made our heroes introspective and subsequently made us introspective, you know. So thank you guys for always trying and, you know, pushing the envelope or pushing the bar forward, as they say. And with that, I thank you. You've been a very, very heroic, invisible audience. Get my shit together. How to get it back for the better. Knew me, old vendetta. Lies never pass. We wanna stack this bread. You can't put the blame on me. And I will detail why you run around. You call your girls to spill.